Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. It is the Weekly Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and it's good to have everyone back. We're glad to be here. I'm joined in studio, as always, by my extremely attractive audio engineer. Your hands are flaking and dry and cracking. Her hands are dry and flaking and cracking, and she will be only with us, she won't be with us the whole time. Maybe. I guess it depends on how interesting the show is, how good the jokes are. If the jokes aren't very good, she'll be out of here. When I get to that part, you'll have to leave. That's all right. So let's get to it, folks. I want to start with this video game, believe it or not. Now, I'm not much of a video gamer. I was when I was very young. I had an Atari system, and then I got good at Galaga I got good at Galaga at the 7-Eleven. No, it wasn't a 7-Eleven. We didn't have 7-Eleven in McKamey, Texas. We had Allsup's. They had a Galaga in there, and they had a Miss Pac-Man. So I got good at those two. But other than that, I never really got into video games. But a lot of people are into video games. There's a game called Minecraft. I was just doing some research. 180 million units have been sold. That's pretty amazing.
It's a puzzle game, right?
I really don't know what it is. Tetris, 170 million.
Oh, yeah.
Or is it billion? It might be billion. I don't know. There's a lot anyway. So video games are big. So I got a story here from the Daily Star over in the United Kingdom about this controversial new game. It's called I Am Jesus Christ is the name of the game. Huh. Yep. And it's apparently you play Jesus in the first person with views of things like healing a woman, right?
Okay.
And then there's a fight scene between Jesus and the devil in the desert. Yeah. And gamers can see through the eyes of Jesus on the cross during the crucifixion. The game trailer says that it covers the period from the baptizing of Jesus all the way through to the resurrection. Some Christians apparently have watched the trailer and they find it disrespectful toward Christianity, and then other heathens, they just make fun of it. I find it interesting that they mention the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the middle of this news story. There's some value right there. Anyway, I'm for the game. Paul says that some people preach Jesus Christ out of greed and for their own stomach, but people get saved anyway. So anyway, I'm for the game. I don't think it's blasphemous. I don't know. I know that Jesus and the devil never actually had a fight in the desert, but I think you're allowed to some creative license. I don't think that's blasphemy necessarily. Anyway, so the game is called I Am Jesus Christ, and even if the makers of the game are heathens, if they actually mention the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that'll get somebody's attention, and it could change their life for all of eternity. So there you go. How about that? So I'm not against the game. I'm not offended, as some of the Christians in here are. The article really has the most annoying thing about the article is all the snide comments by all the hell-bound heathen scum out there. Yeah. That's really annoying. The Christians being offended, whatever. Don't have such thin skin. Just having the gospel mentioned is pretty good stuff. All right, now we'll move on. Should we go now? I want to talk about moving, because we're moving here at the McBurney compound. I know that's shocking because we've got the compound out here, and just a few weeks ago, we were actually building a second goat house. You remember? And so why did we build a second goat house and now we're moving? Well, because we needed a second goat house at the time. Because here's the thing about Colorado. But come November, December, it gets cold. It can get like 15 degrees below zero. It's insanely cold. And so the goat house was not an option. Whether we were staying here or not, we had too many goats for one house. So we had to build the second goat house, and now we are moving. And moving, on your own, you know, without hiring a mover, consists of basically completing a series of impossible tasks in a completely absurd time frame, during which the original list of insurmountable tasks is ever expanding. And that's where we are right now. The list of tasks keeps expanding, and the absurd time frame, that hasn't changed at all. Yeah. The absurd time frame never changes. It's just anyway. So we put a bunch of stuff up on we put stuff up on Craigslist, and then I found out from a younger person that Craigslist is old news. Yeah, you're supposed to put it all on Facebook Marketplace now. So we did that. We put some stuff up on Facebook Marketplace, and we put up a pair of Tiffany champagne flutes in a Tiffany box. Yeah, it was a gift from a real estate agent. Yeah, and not that we didn't love the gift. It's just that number one, we don't drink champagne, and number two, getting a Tiffany box with two crystal flutes across state lines, probably not going to work. So we figured we would put them up on Craigslist, and then someone told us no Facebook. So we put them up on Facebook. I get a call the next day. Not a call, whatever you get on Facebook. I got a post, a message, I don't know. Anyway, and I say, this buyer says I'm interested. I said, okay, well, if you want the address, you have to call me on the phone. Because I need to confirm that they're real people, you know, because there's a lot of creeps and freaks and weirdos out there on the internet. So I get a phone call. Bring, bring. I answer the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
Said hello. And the person on the other end of the line says, this is Alex. I'm calling about the Tiffany champagne flutes. I'm very interested. And so I got like that shiver, like, ew, oh, gross. So anyway, turns out Alex lives in Denver, and we're way out here. And so that was the first issue. Well, the first issue was the lisp, okay? Then the second issue was the distance. And then third, he says, would you take $25 for them? Now, I listed them for $40. $40. Look them up, folks. A set of Tiffany crystal champagne flutes costs $100. And then there's shipping and whatever, right?
So free.
What?
It was free.
Well, but still, I'm talking market value here. I mean, you guys lowballing me. $25 for a pair of Tiffany champagne flutes in the Tiffany box, by the way. All with the paper and everything. Well, turns out I'm heading into Denver the next day. I just want to get rid of the flutes. So I said, hey, Alex, I will be at Dr. XYZ's at this address. I'll be there from 8 to 5. And, yeah, I was out training a doctor. That's right. Doug McBurney barely made it through high school training a medical doctor. And at the end of the training, by the way, the doctor said he learned a lot, which is pretty cool. But anyway, not to digress. So I tell Alex that I'll be at this doctor's office, and he can meet me there anytime, 8 to 5, and he can pick up. I'll leave him at the front desk. Just make sure you leave the $25, cheap little homo. Anyway, so I walk into Dr. XYZ's office in a rather gentrified area of Denver. Let me just put it that way. And this doctor walks out of his office, and he looks like he stepped off the cover of Gentleman's Quarterly magazine. He's got some insanely expensive glasses on. He's got a three-piece suit with the bright pink silk back on the vest. And custom-tailored pants and some French shoes that look like they cost at least $1,000 with a button flap on the side. Anyway, the guy's a fashion plate. And myself, being personally fully confident in my heterosexuality, I can just say, hey, the guy looked good. I mean, the guy looked like he knew fashion. The guy had taste, right? So anyway, I'm unpacking my stuff. And one of the things I unpack is a Tiffany box. And the doctor looks and he says, what's that? And I said, well, funny you should ask, doctor. And I tell him the whole story of Alex and the lowball and how Alex is going to come by. Now, I left out the part that he's a homo because that wasn't really relevant to the conversation. But I told the doctor, yeah, I said I was going to bring him the champagne too. But he lowballed me. And so he's not getting the champagne. And so the doctor says, Doug, the Tiffany box alone is worth $20. He said, I'll give you $40 for those. And I said, all right. So I gave the Tiffany box to the dapperly dressed doctor. And I got to call Alex. Actually, I just texted him. And I said, hey, Alex, the doctor offered me the full $40. So I don't own him anymore. And that was our adventure. And then that was the only fun, interesting, cool thing that has happened during the move. Everything else has been miserable and frustrating and difficult. We have a 30-yard roll-off in our driveway. A 30-yard. That would normally hold like an entire roof. And it's a dumpster, by the way, for those of you who are... Anyway, so we got this 30-yard dumpster. It's the biggest one you can get. And we have basically filled it with, I would say, 80% of everything we've purchased in the last 30 years is in that dumpster. We're going to fill that dumpster, and then we're going to fill two pods. Not pods, they're pack rats. By the way, folks, pack rats are cheaper, and the structures themselves have more integrity. It's a better unit. Yeah. Not that they'll ever advertise on the show, because we don't accept that. We don't tolerate advertisers. But we'll give credit where credit is due. The pack rat, they came on time. The units are clean, and they're structurally just a little beefier. So anyway, so we got all that going on. And, oh, well, there was one other cool thing that happened. I don't know if I've told this story on the air. I don't know. Anyway, so we have two riding lawnmowers. Why do we have two riding lawnmowers? Because I'm not mechanically inclined. And we had one riding lawnmower. It was a 2004 that the previous owners of this house left with us because it was so rickety and shaggy and broken down. And it barely ran. And so it broke down after the first year or two. And so we went out and bought another one, brand new one. Shiny, yellow, bright. Anyway, so we had this 2004 Cub Cadet sitting in the barn for the better part of 3 or 4 years, something like that. And my family came out to visit over this past summer, and my nephew came out with them. He was one of the drivers, you see, because some of my family are, well, they're a little older than you would want to be driving across the country, and they refuse to fly. I can't comprehend it myself. I said, I'll buy you a ticket, Mom, Dad, come on out. No, I'm not getting on a plane. Eh. I'd rather be hit in the face with a cat. I'm not getting on a plane. That's my dad. And my mom feels about the same way. They don't want to be strip searched and give up their dignity at this point in their lives trying to get on an airplane. So anyway, we rented a van. They all came out. My nephew is one of the drivers. He lays on me that he just graduated from auto mechanic and body shop school. So he's now some sort of certified automotive technician, mechanic, and also does body work. And so I immediately put him to work, and they were staying at my house for a week. So we put him to work. The first thing he did was put all the pieces on my extremely attractive audio engineer's car that she has broken off over time, over the past, past few weeks. As I patched the side of the garage while my nephew put the pieces back on the driver's side of the car. And so anyway, he was piecing the car back together, and he did all that, and he still got like 4 or 5 days they're staying. So the next thing I do is I put him on the snowblower project. So we get on the snowblower, hasn't worked for 2 winters. Now, fortunately, we had mild winters, but the snowblower's been sitting in the barn. And he fixed the snowblower. He helped me. He told me how. Him and his uncle, they all, between the three of us, it took us about a half an hour. We got the snowblower going. So now I'm on a roll, right? Or I feel like we're on a roll. So I go into the barn and I roll out the 2004 Cub Cadet sun bleached, beat up with wires with black tape. And it just, I mean, it's got hornet's nests in it and rat's nests in it, right? So I haul that thing out of the barn. Over the course of 3 or 4 days, after investing, I don't know, about $100 in parts, by golly, he got that thing to fire up. He got that thing to fire up. And so that thing was running, and I put that up on Marketplace and sold it in a day or two for $150. And by the way, the car that my nephew pieced together, because my family had come out and I thought I'd rented him a full-size SUV, but it turned out it was a Kia Sorento. That does not qualify. And so six people were going to go back, have to go back to all the way to New York in a Kia Sorento. And so my extremely attractive audio engineer decided that she would give my nephew the car. So he took the Sequoia, right? He took the Sequoia and put my mom and dad in the back. Now they're like royalty instead of packed into pack rats, right? Like sardines they were in that thing. So anyway, they got to ride back to New York in style. And my nephew got a car, which has helped him get a job. And so a lot of cool stuff has been going on here at the McBurney compound. But it's time for us to go to another compound. And so we may not be with you next week because we very well may be en route. Or we could be in a snowbank somewhere. No. Let's hope not. Let's hope. No. Yes. No. No snowbanks. Anyway, I asked a coworker. He asked me, how can I pray for you this week? I said, pray for good weather. And he said, okay. I said, well, I said, now, I don't actually believe in praying for weather myself, but I think if you pray for me to have good weather, I think that's all right. Let's go walking. And I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the show. It's good to have you. So this friend of mine, coworker, a colleague who asked me how he could pray for me. Him and I got into one of our other coworkers called it a Jesus Smackdown. He said, I'm watching a Jesus Smackdown here. Yeah, so we were just debating theology and Calvinism and is the future open or settled. We were just having a debate. Well, then the reason I got into this debate, or the reason I allowed it to happen, and it went on for a couple of hours, well into the night. And the reason I wanted to have this debate with my colleague was because one of my other coworkers was there too, sitting around the campfire, and he was a thalidomide baby. And so he has a deformity of his arms, right? And so when I started talking with my one coworker about Calvinism and predestination, things like that, the God's knowledge and time, we were just having a debate. But then I looked over and I saw my other colleague and I realized, you know, this might be some stuff that this guy has never heard before. This guy maybe has blamed God his whole life for what happened to him, because Christians often say that, well, God knows the future, or God predestined this, or everything happens for a reason, right? So anyway, he got to hear for about 2 hours, me smacking down every Calvinist argument about God's foreknowledge and predestination. So, and then now we're all going to get together again. We haven't been able to get together again. And I didn't address the thalidomide baby guy. I don't know how to say that. Anyway, have to keep everybody confidential, you know. You don't want to reveal anybody's identity. So anyway, I didn't really talk much with the thalidomide baby guy because I figured I'm not going to push this on him. I'm just going to introduce these ideas to him. And then at some point in the future, I will have an opportunity to witness to him more thoroughly. And hopefully that will come in the spring. I hope so. And so anyway, I just want to thank my brother out there. He knows who he is. If he listens, I doubt he listens, but... if he does, he knows who he is. And by the way, we had good weather. I just want to say, now, I personally don't believe that God intervenes physically in the world right now. Only because, not that he can't, or not that he couldn't. I just don't think he finds it to be of benefit to do that at this time. That's just my personal belief. But my friend who wanted to pray for me to have good weather, he disagrees with me on that. Thinks it's... Anyway, so here's the thing. On the first day of the, let's just call it the move event that began, or let's just call it the move crisis Because when you're moving, everything seems like a crisis all the time. At least to me. There may be other people who deal with it better, but to me it may be, it feels like all the time. Well, the first thing we had to do was we had to hose out our garage of all the cobwebs and oil and dirt and chicken poop and everything. And so, and it's winter in Colorado, so using a hose is not always optional, right? Well, on the first day of the crisis, the good Lord gave us just enough sunlight to thaw out the hose so that we were able to hose out the garage. And then when it came time when I had to power wash everything because we let our chickens free range, and you know what that means for all concrete surfaces, for all decorative stone, for all patios, okay, that means that they're caked with, 3 to 5 years worth of, So I get the power washer out, and the good Lord grants me just enough sunlight before the snowstorm moves in, before the cold front moves in, that I basically power wash everything. And so anyway, I'm not persuaded that the Lord intervenes, but I do say that all good things come from the Lord, including the sunshine and the warm that we've been granted, a reprieve from this oppressive winter, so that we could get everything done that we need to get done in this housing crisis. That's right. We're going to call this a housing crisis. Forget about living under a bridge. Try moving yourself and all your kids and everything you own. That's a housing crisis. Oh, yeah. And then there's the goats and the chickens and the peahen and the bunny rabbits and the parakeets and the ducks. Yeah. So a long time ago, many, 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 many years ago, when my extremely attractive audio engineer and I were quite young and quite poor, we arrived in Colorado with everything we owned on top of a Daihatsu Charade. And how many cats? Three cats. Four cats. Four cats we arrived here with. And none of those cats actually made it out here to the compound. So anyway, we're leaving the compound now with everything we own in a box on a truck, and six goats, 47 chickens. No, how many chickens? 53. 53 chickens, two peahen,
and three kids.
Two rabbits, three kids, and three ducks. Four ducks? Three ducks.
I mean, when we came, we didn't have kids.
When we came, we didn't have the kids, right. Yeah. Had the cats. So the cats have been replaced.
The family multiplied.
That's right. Now the cats have been replaced by children, and we like them just fine. All right. Now, speaking of cats, listen to this story from another UK newspaper, The Mirror. A kitten born with two heads is fighting for its life, having survived a difficult birth. This cat was born in central Thailand last Monday night, and the owner said she came home from work and found her cat was struggling in labor, and so she took the cat to a veterinary clinic where it underwent a cesarean section, on a cat, to safely bring the two-headed female kitten into the world, so the kitten has survived. The kitten's heart and lungs were so weak that medics had to perform CPR to keep it breathing. How do you perform CPR on a kitten?
You can't.
I guess so, huh? If you're, this is why veterinary school is harder than a regular medical school, right? I mean, CPR is hard enough. Imagine on a kitten. Anyways, incredibly, according to the Mirror, incredibly, the kitten was kept alive and returned home with its mother and brothers and sisters. And the owner of the cat named both of the cat's heads. One name means money and the other means gold, respectively. Okay, that's fine. She has to use a syringe to feed both heads, as they cannot drink by themselves. So, anyway, that's a heartwarming story, right? It is a heartwarming story, and I think it's great that this lady goes to such a effort to keep this kitten alive. But the reason I want to talk about this story, or what I would like to allude to in regards to this story, is that if this had been a child born with some congenital defect, or if that defect had been detected while the child was in utero, it's quite possible that that child would have been killed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he might have been killed in the womb or by the doctors after birth, shortly after birth, or maybe even not even too shortly after birth. I mean, the extent that this woman goes to keep that kitten alive is more than some hospitals and doctors and parents will go to keep their own children alive. And that's just sad. That's all. But this story is a good story. I like it. And I'm not, excuse me, I'm not necessarily a cat person, but I like cats just fine. Okay. Now, we go from a heartwarming story to, we go to reason number 1,214, to get or keep your children out of the government schools. Planned Parenthood has announced that it has partnered with the County of Los Angeles and the Los Angeles Unified School District to open 50 taxpayer-funded centers that will distribute birth control drugs, okay, birth control drugs and provide pregnancy options counseling. Pregnancy options counseling. Let's see. In an Orwellian twist, it is calling the new in-school programs well-being centers. Yeah, well-being center, where they give you abortion pills or they counsel you on how to go have a surgical abortion if you need them anymore, but they're very passé. Surgical abortions. They're kind of like Craigslist. They're like yesterday's news because now they just give you pills. That's what the drugs are. The birth control drugs, those are abortion pills. Those aren't. I mean, yeah, they give them birth control pills, which may be an abortifacient themselves, by the way. But they also give them straight up abortion pills. Students, according to, let's see, Breitbart, students don't have to worry about missing school just to access quality health care, education, and resources provided by Planned Parenthood. Breitbart didn't say that. Planned Parenthood said that. Let's see. The Los Angeles Times noted that California law allows minor children older than 12 to obtain birth control and other confidential treatment without parental consent. Other confidential treatment without parental consent. Wow. California's mandatory comprehensive sex education project was legislatively maneuvered by Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, as we have covered here, and includes instruction. Well, it includes instruction in things that we can't mention here on the air because we're decent people. We don't talk about stuff like that. Let's see here now. Let's see. They teach them about all this stuff that I can't talk about, starting in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the... parents are upset. Some parents, a few, are outraged because this instruction in stuff that I can't talk about. They say that I've got a quote from a parent here out at the LAISD or USD, LAUSD. That's not an independent school district. It's a United School District. Okay. Anyway, one father, a parent from Murrieta, he says, they discuss things that if it were to be shown, if the materials they teach in class were to be shown to a child outside of school, the person showing it, the adult who showed it to that kid, would be arrested. And that's an absolute fact. If it were done anywhere except in the classroom, you'd be arrested for it. But Planned Parenthood is doing it in the classroom. They're showing it. They're talking about it. They're teaching it. They're encouraging it right there in the classroom. And to this dad, John and Marietta, is that not enough? Is that what more do you need, John? Do you need them to set your child on fire in order for you to understand the danger you're putting your child in? John and Marietta, get your kids out of the government schools. is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's good to have everybody. The name of the song, by the way, is Pornograffiti. And it's an anti-pornography statement made by a hair metal band in the 1980s, believe it or not. Appreciate it, guys. Very much so. And now we get to the part of the show where my extremely attractive audio engineer may decide it's better to go start loading stuff into a truck than to do this. And it's only 20 degrees outside. From the Gross New World file, there's a construction of a new Navy ship has just been undertaken in San Diego. And the name of the ship is the USS Harvey Milk. That's right. Construction began last Friday on the Milk. That's just... All right. It'll be a fleet oiler. Okay. named for the first openly homo man elected in the state of California. All right. Milk was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1978 and then was shot to death 10 months later by an ex-supervisor in what appears to be a purely political dispute, as a matter of fact. Milk was forced to resign from the Navy after being caught in a park in San Diego, and I'll say no more about that. I don't think you need to say. He was also a known pedophile. Yeah, but that's all been scrubbed from history, the pedophilia accusations. The credible accusations of pedophilia have all been scrubbed from history. And so can you imagine you go into the Navy and you're going to serve on the USS Harvey Milk? All right. Well, I guess it's not so much of a stretch for the Navy. No, I'm just kidding. So I'm a Marine, so we have kind of a friendly, yeah. What was it Churchill said? Didn't Churchill say about the British Navy that it was, I can't remember the exact quote, but Churchill was good for quotes. He's, what keeps the Royal Navy running? It's sodomy, rum, and the lash, I believe is how he put it. All right, so there you go. The USS Harvey Milk. Now, is there any way that the current administration can stop something like this? I mean, of course, Donald Trump has no problem with this, so why would he? So let's go from there over to the bad religion file, where the German Catholic Bishops' Conference has issued a statement declaring homosexuality to be just as normal as heterosexuality, while adding that adultery can no longer be considered a serious sin. And so now, if you take the first position, then the second one is true, right? I mean, if you're gonna say homos are just like us, then yeah, adultery can't really be serious. So I can see the logic that you're following, Mr. German Bishop, but it's just wrong is all it is. Yeah, homosexuality is a criminal offense. Not only is it a sin, it's a crime. And it has been for like 5,000 years up until Stonewall. Anyway, the bishops in Germany embraced the findings of a study. I apologize. I don't want to offend any of my Catholic brothers and sisters. The bishops embraced, no, not one another. They embraced the findings of a study group on sexual morality chaired by the Berlin Archbishop Heiner Koch. So they did a study group on sexual morality. Really? So you're a Catholic bishop and you feel like you need a study group on sexual morality? That right there indicates there's a problem, because things as simple as sexual morality and immorality should be fairly well understood by the time you're an archbishop, or even a bishop, or even a pastor, or even a lay leader, or even an altar boy. Or even, what do they call just the average Catholic in the pew? They have a name for that. A layperson. Anybody. All right, but here we are. Anyway, they say any form of discrimination against homos must be rejected. So let's just put what's coming next. Any form of discrimination against adulterers must be rejected. That'll be in the next synod way of the church directory, get out of here. Okay, that's sad. We move from that to the straight-up queer religion file, where we go to Sweden for that. Right? Huh? Are we shocked for the straight-up queer religion? No. So there is a illustration created by Elizabeth Olsen Wallen, offered to the St. Paul Church in Malmo, Sweden, where it was placed to the right of the main altarpiece on the first Sunday of Advent, December 4th. All right, so here's the thing. I don't know what an altar piece is because I'm not a Catholic. I'm not even sure what Advent is, right? I mean, I just never looked into it that deeply. I know it has to do with standing around moaning, right? And wearing a weird hat. I don't understand all this. But basically, it looks to me like this illustration was put up on the dais in front of the whole church to be viewed by the church, I believe, on the first day of Advent, which is December 1st. So maybe Advent is December. I don't know. Anyway, so this piece was offered, and the church accepted. The St. Paul Church in Malmo accepted this illustration. And here's what's on the illustration. Perched in a tree, a transsexual woman is dressed as a serpent, dangling a snake from her hand. There are two Eves on one side of the tree and two Adams on the other, openly flirting. And so the pastor of the church and the bishop and the archbishop or whoever with the biggest hat, they accepted this illustration and actually put it up in front of the church, in front of the people in the church. And it stayed there for several days. Looks like close to 2 weeks, but last Wednesday, the diocese said it would remove it from the altar. Why? Well, they were outraged. They weren't really outraged, actually. Here's what the diocese wrote in a statement. They said, "The fact that there are two homosexual couples in the artwork is completely uncontroversial. But the fact that there is a snake, which traditionally symbolizes evil, and it turns into a trans person, could lead to the interpretation that a trans person is evil or is the devil. The Swedish church can absolutely not stand for that." Yeah. Okay. The pastor of St. Paul, Sophia, said, quote, "We've been marrying gay couples for 10 years. And with this artwork, it was a bit like hanging up a wedding photo in the church." Unquote.
Is she from Harvey Milk?
Yeah, maybe she's a... She'll be painting the deck on the USS Harvey Milk sometime soon. All right, that's just disturbing. That's from the queer religion file. All right, and then we got out of it. Well, look, we made it through. We made it through all the stories about the homos. And now we go to autonomous cars. What's happened to the autonomous cars? I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and I told him I thought it would be, this was probably last year. It could be 2 years ago because time is going twice as fast as it used to. I don't know why, but it is. It could have been 2 years ago, but I said I thought it would be about 10 years before any significant number of autonomous cars were on the road. And he said, "Oh, no, it's going to be 2 or 3 years." And I thought, yeah, I don't think so. I think it's harder than people are making it out. The main reason I suspected autonomous cars would take longer than we all thought was because the main pusher of the idea that we were all going to be in autonomous cars, self-driving cars, was Elon Musk, who I do not trust. I don't like him. I don't trust him. I think he's a bamboozler and a shakedown artist, and he's basically conned his way into being a billionaire. And I know everyone thinks he's a genius. Well, forgive me. I'm not that impressed. I'm sorry. Anyway, according to the French Press Association, Dateline New York, the first driverless cars were supposed to be deployed on the roads of America in 2019, but it's just a few days before the end of the year. So guess what, folks? Yeah. This is AFP says the lofty promises of car manufacturers and Silicon Valley remain far from becoming a reality. Far, yes. Let's see here. The technology is not ready, according to Dan Albert, author of the book Are We There Yet? On the History of the American Automobile. Well, that's a pretty good title for a book on the history of the American automobile. Are we there yet? I mean, every single child in America has uttered that phrase at some point, annoying the adult in the driver's seat. Anyway, so it's a good turn of a phrase, Mr. Albert, so I'll consider your opinion. He says the technology is not ready, and I agree. It's obviously not ready, or it would be everywhere. Let's see. He says the big problem with self-driving cars is perception. Meaning the software's ability to process data sent by the motion sensors to detect other vehicles, pedestrians, animals, cyclists, or other objects, and then predict their likely actions and adapt accordingly. Yeah. Avide Zakor, Avide, I've got an engineering and computer science professor from UC Berkeley named, we'll just call him Avi. Avi says the perception part is not solved yet. The most advanced publicly available is 80 to 85% reliable. And that means 15% of the time it's going to hit objects and kill and destroy them. Okay, that's not good. I mean, if a human driver had an accident 15% of the time, they would take his license away. Right? So it's not there yet, okay? General Motors had promised a fleet of autonomous vehicles would be on the roads in 2019. And they ginned up their stock price a little bit on that, whatever. Didn't work out. Elon Musk, the aforementioned Elon Musk, a bamboozler extraordinaire, said in late October of this year, 2019, that his cars, he said, my cars will be able to drive from one's house to work, most likely without interventions. Although it will still be supervised. Slip that in at the end, Elon. So he said, most likely without interventions? What does that mean, Elon? That means not self-driving. Yeah, so they do have self-driving vehicles on the road right now, but they have a human inside in case something goes wrong. So that means that's not a self-driving car. Let's see. So Elon Musk, bogus. He's just such a bogus, fake, phony baloney. Our the author of Are We There Yet, Dan Albert, told AFP that Tesla may have overpromised. Imagine that. And he says all the customers who paid him $3,500 in advance for the promised fully autonomous features, he says, well, they effectively gave the company a no-interest loan. Unquote. Yeah. Elon Musk has been good at that, bamboozling people into giving him money for things that don't actually work yet. I mean, the guy is a genius in that respect. But is that something to respect? I think not. All right. Get out of here, Elon. And meanwhile, we go to the aliens file. That's right. No, maybe we... Aliens! Yes. They've got a Sputnik News. Why do all my alien stories come from Sputnik News? Maybe I need to double and triple check these. Anyway, they say an object was spotted in the sky over a California city, and it was seen by more than 100 witnesses. Uh-huh. Yep, they said that the object didn't move, and it emitted no sound whatsoever. The object was hovering above the small town of Menifee, California, where it was allegedly witnessed by more than 100 people. How do we know this? Because a video was uploaded online. Yeah. And the uploader claims the object was seen by over 100 witnesses. And he also says, what else is... Oh, the uploader's name is UFOs and Aliens Santana. So that's a reliable news source. So I don't need to double check or triple check this. We've got UFOs and Aliens Santana and Sputnik News both on it. That's triple checked. It's double checked already. So the uploader says at one point, the UFO hovered in the same spot for over 5 minutes. That's according to UFOs and Aliens Santana. Hey, Santana, hovering by definition means that it's in the same spot. So you didn't really have to, just a lot of extra words. That's all I'm saying. When you're posting stuff online, it's better to be pithy. And brevity is the soul of wit, you know. And then they go on to quote other people who uploaded posts, comments to UFO Santana's post. As if that's news. You got some guy in his pajamas in a basement somewhere commenting on a UFO video. How does that make the papers? Sometimes they are hilarious. Listen to this. UFO activity is increasing so fast, says one poster. The world is going to get a big wake-up call. Before this guitar solo even gets started, we're just going to stop this. just goes on for too long. Like that's all. Jimmy Page. Anyway, so that post to the UFO story, that post was not ha-ha funny, but it did make you question the sanity or intelligence of the poster, which that always strikes me as funny. Meanwhile, from the Culture File, the Los Angeles Public Library has decided to eliminate late fines. That's right. And what bothers me, several things bother me, obviously, all the time. I'm generally cranky. But KTLA opens the story, "Bibliophiles Rejoice! Late fees are going to become a thing of the past." So anyway, why should we rejoice over the relaxing of rules so that libraries can get their books back on time so other people... Why should we rejoice that we can now keep the books over and not have to pay a fine? I'm supposed to be happy about that? I'm not happy about it. Well, the library has decided to end overdue fines, and Mayor Eric Garcetti thought that was important enough that he announced it himself, the mayor of Los Angeles. Okay. Additionally, the library will get rid of the $10 non-refundable service fee for lost items. Okay.
Wow. Well, why would anybody return it?
I know. That's what I started asking through the story, you know. You know, they say that these fees, they primarily affect underprivileged communities. You know. That's right. That's why they're getting rid of them. Because they primarily affect underprivileged communities.
They would have time to bring it.
Well, listen to this. That's right. If you're underprivileged, you'd think that, you know, what do you got going on? You're obviously not working. You don't got time to go back to the library, bring your book back. You know, you're sitting around reading that book. So you can't finish it on time. That's the problem in the underprivileged community. So now the new policy, they say, won't change replacement costs. Whatever that means. I don't understand. Which the cost will still be incurred when materials are overdue by more than 45 days. So apparently after 45 days, they assume that you have stolen it, I guess. And patrons will still have to pay for damaged materials. So if you damage the book, of course, if replacement costs and payments for damaged materials at some future date appear to primarily affect underprivileged communities, then they'll be eliminated too. And then that's the end of the library in Los Angeles. That's it. One of the greatest institutions in all of human history is the library, by the way. So anyway, this would effectively mean the end of the library. Okay? You know, the only saving grace here may be that no one in Los Angeles reads books. So there's no market for stolen books. So there's no motivation to steal the books. So that might preserve the lifespan of the library for a little while. From there, we go into the urinalism file. Yes, I said into the urinalism file, unfortunately. And the story is horrible. It's the anti-Semitic murder out in Jersey City, New Jersey. The killers who stormed a kosher grocery store in New Jersey, killing three and murdering a veteran detective, have been identified as David Anderson and Francine Graham. Sources say Anderson was a one-time follower of the Black Hebrew Israelite movement, a group whose members believe they are descendants of the ancient Israelites and may adhere to both Christian and Judaic beliefs. Okay. So really? You have to mention that? Why would NBC in New York insert Christians and Jews into the very middle of a story about murder and hatred and violence? And I mean, this is a violent hate crime story of a violent hate crime. And right in the middle of it, they say that the perpetrators adhere to both Christian and Judaic beliefs, neither of which endorse murdering people, by the way. Just to be clear, the folks at CNN, the urinalists at, not CNN, I'm sorry, NBC. The urinalists at NBC just slipped that right in the middle of the story there. And anti-Semitism is on the rise. And that's always a danger signal for world history, by the way. It always is. And it's amazing how it usually only takes a century or less for anti-Semitism to ebb and then flow again. I mean, how long ago did the Holocaust end? 1945. What is that, 70, 75 years ago? Anyway, we're right on time. It's a shame. Okay, speaking of a shame, you know, I'm ashamed of Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin. This is from the Justice File. Lexington, Kentucky, according to the Lexington Tribune. It's not clear, they say, if Betty Carnes was killed by asphyxiation or by the 8 blows to her head that Delmar Parton delivered with a metal pipe. The coroner couldn't tell which killed the mother of 3 first. But it was very clear that her head was then chopped off, placed in her lap in a 55-gallon barrel that was destined for a toxic waste site. Uh-huh. Delmar Parton was convicted of that murder. On Monday, departing Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin pardoned.
What?
Pardoned Delmar Parton.
Wow.
Who was convicted of killing Betty Carnes, chopping her head off and stuffing her in a barrel. I'm just stunned. The prosecutor in the case calls the pardon mystifying.
Yeah,
The prosecutor says, I think it's arrogance of one who has a godlike image of himself, of Bevin, and a lack of concern for anybody else. Anyway, there's got to be something going on behind the scenes that we don't know about here. Well, how could you possibly? Matt Bevin, by the way, was the Republican governor that Donald Trump flew into Kentucky and stumped for. I hope Trump is shocked. I wonder if Trump will tweet about this. I hope so. The pardon, according to the Tribune, was one of several controversial pardons and commutations Bevin issued in his final days in office, including a teacher who pleaded guilty to possession of child pornography.
What is the matter with this?
I have no idea. And then there was another, Patrick Baker. Patrick Baker was one of 3 men convicted of murder in Knox County in 2014. Patrick Baker's brother and sister-in-law held a fundraiser for Matt Bevin, raised about $20,000 for him, and personally contributed $4,000 before Bevin pardoned their brother, a convicted murderer. Wow. Anyway, I hope when Matt Bevin steps out of the governor's mansion, he's arrested. This is outrageous. Anyway, we'll probably find out what's stinking under the surface out there in Kentucky that would cause him to do all that. Man, Matt Bevin. An accessory to murder, basically. Yeah, Matt Bevin, accessory to murder. Dateline Houston from the Domestic Tranquility File. Authorities spoke last week with 22-year-old Jared Ramos about missing person reports filed in November for his grandmother and his great-grandmother. The body of his 90-year-old great-grandmother was found in a trash can in the backyard. Shortly after this discovery, 22-year-old Jared Ramos confessed to strangling both his grandmother and his great-grandmother, who was later found in a tote bag behind a church. Okay. In Spring, Texas, outside of Houston. Authorities say that that Jared Ramos has not expressed remorse for his confessed actions. And Ramos reportedly told law enforcement officers when asked, why did you kill your grandmother and your great-grandmother? He told law enforcement officers that he was tired of them, quote, tired of them, unquote. So to a 22-year-old who's been raised in an environment where murder is an option when you have a problem, sometimes just being tired of other people means that, you know, you might just kill them because you're tired of them. And Jared Ramos may not fully comprehend the extreme nature of what he's done because of the way he's been raised. He doesn't understand the gravity of the situation. He may not fully comprehend the gravity of the situation is what I'm trying to say. Because of the way he was raised, probably by his grandmother and his great-grandmother, and everyone else who had an influence on his life, including the government school teachers and the pop culture. Yeah, he may not fully comprehend what he has done here. I think that's totally possible. Not that he shouldn't be punished and put to death for it. I'm just saying it's quite possible that this next generation coming up, the kiddos in their late teens, early 20s, they may not fully comprehend the gravity of murder because they've been trained that it's just not that serious. All right. Which is a sad state. All right. Now, the Venezuelan refugee crisis, according to the Brookings Institute, the crisis is just about to surpass the scale of the Syrian crisis. Now, since 2014, we've all been hearing about some 4.8 million people that had fled Syria. By 2015, 4.8 million had fled Syria. And that led to a crisis, I mean, around the world, definitely in Europe. Well, 4.6 million Venezuelans have fled. About 16% of the population. The crisis is one of the largest in modern history now, according to Brookings. And unlike other refugee crises, Venezuela is not the result of a conventional war or conflict. Yeah. Since 2013, the Venezuelan economy has contracted by 65%, the largest contraction outside of a war in 45 years. Comparators are Liberia, which lost 90% of its GDP, but that was during a bloody civil war. Venezuela is quickly becoming a failed state if it hasn't become one already, according to the Brookings Institute. There are no simple solutions, they say, says Brookings. Yeah, follow think tank. All the big brains at Brookings. They say the crisis is politically complex, protracted, and involves over 17 regional host nations. A key step must be greater coordination between host nations and donors. The UN hostage, HCR, and the IOM, we need... No, it's not really... There is a simple solution. There is, yeah. You arrest, try, and execute most of the existing government. And if that means an outside government needs to do it, that's what needs to happen. And whoever topples the murderous, thieving regime there needs to install a God-fearing executive. And the crisis will be solved in less than 9 months. That all they need is a God-fearing executive in Venezuela, and he would solve the crisis within about 9 months. I'd love to take a shot at it. All we need to do is topple the regime. And then I'm sure there's still at least one God-fearing man in Venezuela that we could find. I bet there's a bunch of them down there. And on another international front, from the war file, the White House has repeatedly... Donald Trump. I'm just going to say Donald Trump because I don't like attributing things to the White House. Donald Trump has repeatedly cited beautiful letters from Kim Jong-un over the past 18 months, insisting that the young North Korean leader is sincere in seeking a denuclearization deal. He wants to make a deal, Trump thinks, because Trump is a rather shallow lightweight. Meanwhile, a high-level defector from Un's regime has sent a letter to Trump warning that he's been tricked into believing the North Korean leader will ever denuclearize and that Washington should instead ramp up a psychological warfare campaign aimed at inspiring North Korea's elites to replace the young dictator from within. This is a high-level defector from Un's regime. This is not a flowery letter from Kim to Don. This defector also says the U.S. should simultaneously impose all-out sanctions against Pyongyang and be prepared to carry out a preemptive strike against Kim Jong-un's nuclear sites. Yes. So who do you think is right? I mean, what do you think is closer to the truth? This high-level defector from Un's regime or the flowery letters that Trump has been getting from the hand of Kim himself, dipped in a little bit of perfume at the end, maybe. Anyway, folks, I hope that Donald Trump is a shrewd strategist who's operating six levels above what I'm able to comprehend. I seriously hope that is true. I mean, that would be better for me and for America than if he is actually the gullible lightweight that he appears to be. But let's hope for the former and hope that the latter is just me not understanding the deep, sophisticated understanding of geopolitics that resides in the gray matter between the ears of the great Donald Trump. Let's hope so, because, man. All right. I think, well, here, we got one more here. Home Depot Holy cow. Home Depot and other retailers lost about $51 billion last year in what they call shrink. Shrink is what they call it. And that's when organized criminals steal millions of dollars worth of goods, and they store the merchandise in warehouses, and then they sell it mostly online. It's gotten so bad that Home Depot's operating profit margins next year will be affected. Wow. And Home Depot executives say that they're tying it directly to the opioid crisis. That's right. They say, we think this ties to the opioid crisis, but we're not positive about that. But they can't figure out what's going on. It's gotten so bad that they think it's got to be something bigger than just average crime. Anyway, they say the addictive nature of opioids coupled with easier ways to hawk stolen goods online have apparently made criminals bolder. Mm-hmm. And by the way, how much stuff at Home Depot is under $900? So in California, it's not even a misdemeanor if you steal $900 worth of tools from Home Depot. And that's coming soon everywhere. God help us. And I mean that. I'm Doug McBurney. I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank my friends at Real Science Radio and at AmericanRightToLife.com. And my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. Should the Lord tarry, we will return from an undisclosed location as soon as possible. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.